Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE, 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, we're heading into the holiday season, folks. We're well into November now, and we're really getting our way through another busy semester here at 1 Washington Mews. On Thursday night, we were delighted to welcome some great ambassadors for the Gaelic Athletic Association, and specifically in commemorating and marking the 100th anniversary of the New York Gaelic Athletic Association. We had Donie O'Sullivan here, an All-Ireland winner, well known in Gaelic Games circles, and he was here to launch and talk about a new documentary called Aspects of Identity, an Enduring Tradition. This is a fantastic grassroots attempt at marking the special anniversary of the New York GAA, and Donie has been involved in a team connected with the likes of Weeshie Fogarty and Christy Reardon and his son Anthony Reardon and John O'Sullivan in pulling together footage and documentation of the experience of people involved in the GAA in the New York City area over the last few decades. We had a great turnout here at 1 Washington Mews on Thursday night to view an excerpt of the documentary and also to hear Donie O'Sullivan chat about the genesis of this project and all the work that went into it. We were so delighted to see the initiative being taken by these filmmakers also in gifting 30 hours of raw footage that was amassed in this project to the Archives of Irish America, and we're delighted to hold the files at Bope's Library here at New York University. Marion Casey, the senior archivist, and my colleague here at Glucksman Ireland House saw fit to get the 1947 All-Ireland football. We have one of the footballs used at the polo grounds at that historic game in the Archives of Irish America, and we were able to bring it over here to us at Glucksman Ireland House on Thursday night so that those attending this special event had an opportunity to see that football. Speaking of Marion, she will deliver our annual Ernie O'Malley lecture next Thursday, November 20th at 7 p.m. We will have Marion talk. The title of her talk is New York's Hill of Assembly, Archbishop John Hughes and St. Patrick's Cathedral. When New York's Catholic Archbishop John Hughes laid the cornerstone for a new cathedral dedicated to St. Patrick, his decision didn't seem to make any sense in some quarters. The location was so far uptown from the old one on Mott Street, the architectural plans were both ambitious and expensive, and the city was still reeling from the impact of the Great Famine in Ireland. Professor Marion Casey will discuss how Hughes's youth in counties Tyrone and Monaghan was the scaffolding upon which the cathedral became a reality. She will argue that in the laying of this specific cornerstone in August 1958, Hughes harnessed ancestral and associational connections embedded in Ireland's landscape and history, particularly in Ulster, to create a mnemonic assembly site in America. This will be a fantastic lecture, folks. As you know, 2014 marks the 150th anniversary of the death of Archbishop John Hughes, who's an iconic figure in the history of New York City and of American Catholicism. We're very much looking forward to Marion's paper, and the event is booking out, folks. If you're interested in coming, please do be in touch with us as soon as possible. The best way to make a reservation is through ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you email that address, or give us a call on 212-998-3950. This event is so much in demand that it will not take place here at 1 Washington Mews. It's actually going to be moved to a larger auditorium on 19 West 4th Street. That's 19 West 4th Street, folks. It's right on the corner of Mercer Street. There's an NYU building, clearly signed 19 West 4th Street. And that's where Marian Casey will deliver New York's Hill of Assembly, Archbishop John Hughes and St. Patrick's Cathedral. So we look forward to seeing you then. In today's program, I'd like us to hear the proceedings of last week's event. We were so delighted to host Tara Bergen here for the annual Tom Quinlan lecture. So I'm going to play some excerpts of that event. We'll get to hear Professor John Waters introduce the event. As we know, Tara Bergen was the Seamus Heaney Poetry Prize winner for this year. We'll hear from Tom Quinlan, after whom the lecture is named. We'll hear from Joe, his son, who's a great supporter and who spoke to us here on the program a couple of weeks ago. And then we'll hear Tara read excerpts of her poetry. Fantastic collection, This is Yarrow. We'll also have the opportunity to speak to Professor John Horgan, who is visiting the United States as the Burns Visiting Scholar at Boston College this semester. Professor Horgan was down in New York during the week, and I had the opportunity to sit down and chat to him about his research, about his role as press ombudsman in Ireland, and about what he's doing here while he's in Boston College. So we'll have that a little bit later on in the programme.
You're very welcome to the Quinlan Family Lecture in Poetry. This is a great night in the Ireland House calendar of events. I'm extremely fortunate to have been involved in exchanges that enabled this to happen, mostly because the people who have come in the door to this great place and come in the door to Ireland House, most especially in the members of the Quinlan family who are teachers and lovers of poetry, who have enabled others throughout Tom Quinlan's long career as a teacher and through the Quinlan family's support of Glucksman Ireland House and of the Irish Studies program here. First, this event is offered in conjunction with the Irish Arts Centre Poetry Festival, and that's become an absolutely signal event in the literary calendar of New York. Every autumn we can look forward to an extraordinary sequence of events bringing new and established poets from Ireland to New York to read their work, and that's all come about through the leadership and guidance of Aidan and also Rachel Gilkey at the Irish Arts Centre, and we're really grateful, Rachel, for all the work that you've done in establishing this connection. But the Irish Arts Centre Poetry Festival is curated by two really remarkable Irish individuals who made New York their home and made a mark in New York, and that's the celebrated and award-winning novelist Belinda McKeon, whose first novel, Solace, should be on your shelf if it's not. Get it and read it and understand it. Belinda teaches now at Rutgers, but she's taught at Columbia, Princeton. When she's a guest at NYU, we're so grateful, and she's a terrific force, and she happens to also be partnered with Angus Woods, who is a philosopher and a poetry critic and a writer of range and talent and brilliance. So Belinda and Angus, thank you for all you've done to make the Irish Arts Centre Poetry Festival an extraordinary moment. And as the Centre for Irish Studies here at New York University, it's wonderful when an institution like the Irish Arts Centre, that's about bringing living culture, living artists into New York, when we can make a harmonic rhythm happen between our academic and intellectual pursuits and the Irish Arts Centre's mission. I'm extremely grateful to Anne Solari for her facilitation of this connection. So thank you all for being here. I also want to welcome members of the Bergen family. I understand that Tara Bergen, whom I'll be introducing in a short while, has met some new friends and old relatives, as it were. You're very welcome here in the house tonight. And we've seen you before, and we hope to see you again. The Quinlan Family Lecture is offered in conjunction with the Seamus Heaney Prize for Poetry, which is awarded by Queen's University Belfast and the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry. The serendipitous connection between Glucksman Ireland House, the Quinlan family, and Queen's University Belfast happened when the funding for the Heaney Prize was zeroed out in a blunder of monumental governmental failure. And when we found that there was possibly a role to play for an American supporter of poetry, and particularly a lover of Seamus Heaney, and of course lovers of Seamus are legion, it was perfect that it rhymed in the way that it did, and it enabled it to happen. And when the announcement of the endowment of the lecture was made several years ago, Seamus made the trip to New York, came here to the house, and renewed his connection, because he had helped to cut the ribbon with Taoiseach Albert Reynolds when Ireland House was established in 1993. That enabled a wonderful conversation that happened with Seamus in the time before he left us too early. And this connection, this lecture, this poetry reading, are testament to what he insisted upon in all of his life and all of his work, which is the importance of poetry for life itself, for who we are as people and as members of a community. And Seamus was especially delighted that the Quinlan Family Lecture Endowment stepped in to help recognize the Heaney Prize for Poetry, because the Heaney Prize for Poetry is offered to the best book of first book of poems published in Britain and Ireland in a given year. And Seamus was quite eloquent and quite emotionally engaged with the idea of how important it is that a poet's first volume get heard and get read and get circulated, and that the poet who has found their way into print and into a volume for the first time finds an audience. And so it was extremely important to Seamus, it's extremely important to us. And so it's appropriate then for me to ask a member of the Quinlan family to say a few words about that relationship. So Joe Quinlan.
Thank you, John. It's really great for this extended Quinlan clan here to be back in the house tonight. Mayor Lou and I live in walking distance, but my nephew Mike, he took the subway. My niece Amy drove in from her job in New Jersey. And my sister Jenny is just back off the plane from an extended trip to Austria. All of us coming from different ways to be here tonight. One person not here tonight, my mom, Virginia, is not really well enough to travel from Philadelphia. But if she were here, she would want you to know that she's the only one of us who's actually born here in New York. Very proudly, just across the river in her native Brooklyn. Accompanying my dad tonight also is an old dear family friend who has shared my father's teaching profession for most of the last 5 decades. That's John Pickler. All of us were here for that wonderful afternoon back in September, 3 short years ago, when this lectureship was announced and celebrated. And we have really vibrant memories, I think, of Seamus, who was seated right there next to Loretta, giving what was really a surprise speech that spoke to the value of teaching literature, specifically poetry, and how important the Heaney Prize was to him. My father had actually met Seamus numerous times in the past 20 years, mostly on his nearly annual visits to the Yates Summer School in August. In fact, this book, Seamus's famous first book when he was a high school teacher actually, is signed for me. My father got the autograph from August of 97, in fact, which I think was the first trip. A little side note, by the way, I took my dad for his 75th birthday, a very memorable trip. He wanted to go to the winter reunion of the Yates Summer School on the last weekend in January. And I want to tell you, the weather that January weekend was a lot like we had here in New York today. Very Irish. I accompanied him on numerous times back to Sligo, and the weather in August is exactly the same, by the way. I've yet to see, in 10 trips to Sligo, I've yet to see the sun, by the way. So. But it's still a great event every August. And, that's actually where my father met Seamus and any number of the other Irish and Northern Irish poets that he came to know so well over there. There were a number of side benefits, though, to these trips. The biggest of which was uncovering and confirming our family's roots in nearby Fermanagh, where my father's grandmother, Cecilia Cox, had been raised before emigrating to Philadelphia in the 19th century. Cecilia was one of 8 children, and she herself was the mother of 8, including her oldest, which was my grandfather, John. I use the word carefully when I say that it was almost a sacred moment when our cousins, whom we met, showed my dad and I the farm and the actual building where Cecilia had been born in 1862. I can only imagine the sacrifices that she made. She'd be proud of tonight's event. Not surprisingly, our cousins from Fermanagh, there are very good students, like my father, and more than one of them moved to the big city and studied, it turns out, at Queen's University Belfast. And for me, at least, it makes the partnership with Queen's and the Heaney Center even more appropriate and very special. And we're thrilled to meet our award winner tonight and welcome her here this evening. But first, it's a little bit of the tradition here. This is our 3rd year of this event. I think most of you know that my dad taught for some, if you read the book, let's see, some 66 years, the first 43 of which were in the Philadelphia public schools. It would have been longer if World War II and his service in it had not delayed his start by 3 years. What you don't know, and neither do I for that matter, is what short poem Tom Quinlan will read when he takes the mic here in a minute. The one thing I do know is he will have thought about it deeply, and he will read it with great conviction. So without further delay, I'd like to introduce you to the best teacher I know, Tom Quinlan.
Okay, I'm not going to use the mic. I'm going to read a poem by Seamus Heaney. I'm going to talk about it a little bit, because that's what teachers do. The poem takes about 2 minutes. The introduction takes about a half an hour. It's really unfair, I think, sometimes to ask you to listen to someone read a poem if you don't have a copy of it. Everyone should have brought a copy with you. I checked at the door with the first 10 people, and I quit. Not only did they not bring the poem, but they didn't know it's called a personal helicon. And the first guy said to me, "What the hell is a helicon?" He said it was a helicopter. For the one or two people who don't know what a helicon is, there are now three of them. I didn't know either. If you look at the dictionary, helicon is a mountain in Greece. It's a magic mountain, and it's dedicated to Apollo. And people have been going up this mountain for thousands of years to seek wisdom and to work out some artistic effect. Writers climb this mountain. It's there today. Dancers, singers, because on top of the mountain, through the years, there are supposed to be 9 muses. And people, Seamus Heaney climbed this mountain, as a matter of fact. And some of them go up and they perform, and they, on top of Narcissus was up there. There's a well up there, and you know the story of Narcissus. So this is a place, a helicon is a place where you seek wisdom and joy and happiness and salvation, I guess. And his personal helicon happened to him when he was a little boy. In Ireland, a long time ago, in Ireland and all over the world for centuries, there were actually two worlds. One was the world of kids, and one was the world of adults. And kids and adults never mixed, and he didn't mix in his family. He had the last thing they told him, the personal helicon, something only a kid could handle, is looking at used wells and farms. They smell, they're dirty, and they have rats in them, and that's the kind of thing that kids like. Their parents, that is, the first thing they tell them, first line of the poem, "As a child, they could not keep me from wells." As soon as your mother says, "Stay away from the well," and they can't wait to get out, and they go over. And this is the story of him seeking some kind of salvation, looking at these various wells. It's a magnificent poem. And he goes on and on and on in the poem and describes each one as he sees it. And finally, he gets to the end, he's a grown man, and he thinks back, and the question comes up, why would a man write a poem about crummy wells? And at the last line of the poem, I'm going to give you that first. You ready? You better be ready. Why do I do it? I rhyme to see myself, to set the darkness echoing. Doesn't get any better than that. That's why he wrote the poem. Now I'm going to read it. Personal helicon. As a child, they could not keep me from wells. An old pump with buckets and windlasses. I love the dark drop, the trapped sky, the smell, and waterweed, fungus, dank moss. As an adult, it's enough to make you vomit. Because this is a kid. That's the way they feel. And now he describes each well. One, in a brickyard with a rotted board top, I stayed with the rich crash where a bucket plummeted down at the end of the rope, so deep, you saw no reflection in it. A shallow one, under a dry stone ditch, fructifying like any aquarium, when you dragged out long roots from the soft mush, a white face hovered over the bottom. It was his face, the reflection. Others had echoes, gave back your own call with a clean new music in it. And one scarce, but there out in the fern, tall foxglove, a rat slapped across my reflection. This was his telecom, because he was a kid. And now, 50 years go by, and he writes the last few lines, wondering what happened to me, and what happens to you, and what happens to all of us. We grow up. Now, to pry into roots, to finger slime, to stare big-eyed narcissus, and to some ring. This is beneath all adult dignity. Isn't that sad? Beyond all adult dignity. And he analyzes, why do I do it? I rhyme. To see myself, to set the darkness echoing. Amen.
I don't like following that. I really don't like being here. But sitting with Tom 3 years ago downstairs at Shannon's, I reminded Shannon of the first time that I met him in 1985 in Dublin, and I asked him to sign the copy that my sister had given me before I went off to school in Ireland of Shannon's first volume. And I opened the book and asked him to sign, and I didn't have him sign on the first page. I asked him to sign on the last page at the end of the book. I remember literally feeling it. He grabbed my arm and said, thank you, that's my favorite poem in the book. So serendipitous in the sense that said. And we talked about that with Tom actually when Shannon was downstairs with Mari Heaney a few years ago. The winner of the 2014 Shannon Heaney Prize for Poetry is Tara Bergen, a native of Dublin, current resident of England, author of This Is Yara, published by Carcanet Press. This is a very rich and very complex terrain of poems that Tara has woven in the fabric of her first published book. So please join me in welcoming Tara Bergen and listen to her second book.
Thank you very much indeed. That's a fantastic introduction, which I will be able to live up to. So, I'm delighted to see you all here. I've never spoken to two rooms at the same time. I'm going to read a lecture, which I think takes about 15 minutes, and then I've got poems that I'm going to read. Now, they're not that long. Some of them are quite short, so don't panic. So I'll start with the lecture, which I've called Ireland as a State of Mind. Well, I'm very pleased and honoured to be standing here as a guest of Glucksman Ireland House, and as a representative of the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry, which awarded me the prize that has facilitated this visit to New York. It's the first time I've been to New York, and it's extremely exciting for me. But most importantly, I'd like to thank the Quinlan family, to whom I have already raised a glass in Belfast on the night of winning the prize, and to whom I will most certainly be raising several more glasses whenever I get the chance. So sláinte to Tom Quinlan and his family. I said I'd get one Irish word in, so I hope you understand that. I think you will. Well, I'm also pleased and honoured to be standing here as a representative of poetry itself. I say this as a sort of disclaimer, a way of letting you know that the lecture I deliver here tonight, I deliver not as an academic or a scholar or a historian, but as a poet. With this in mind, I would like to begin by reading from a piece of writing by Robert Graves, carefully cut out photocopy of which I received in the post several years ago, sent to me by my father. My own affection for Grays goes back to a time when I had just begun my university studies of literature and was reading The White Goddess. To my surprise, in the first pages of the introduction, Grays confirmed for me a fact that up till then I'd assumed was merely known and discussed by my immediate family, namely that a man named Amergin, which in English is Bergen, was the first true poet of Europe. So excited was I by this confirmation that I took the book to my English professor the very next morning with the suggestion that he should not be starting his lectures with the Canterbury Tales or the Odyssey, but instead with the Song of Amergin, the poem which I had been hearing since I was a baby, and a translation of which Grays includes in his introduction to The White Goddess. Needless to say, my outburst made little impact on my professor's teaching schedule, as far as I know. But now that I've confessed this very embarrassing incident to you, I can go ahead and read the following passage, which is taken not from The White Goddess, but from Grays' The Cave for Xanthippe. And it goes like this. I am no outlaw by temperament. I simply suffer from a poetic obsession, which an increasing number of reasonable people share with me. Poetry for us means not merely poems, but a peculiar attitude to life. Though philosophers like to define poetry as a rational fantasy, for us it is a practical, humorous, reasonable way of being ourselves, of never acquiescing in a fraud, of never accepting the second rate in poetry, painting, music, love, friends, of safeguarding our poetic institutions against the encroachments of mechanized, insensate, inhumane, abstract rationality. It's a powerful and rousing statement, and one which, although written in 1960, still carries great significance, I think. It's the kind of maxim that, for me, serves to clarify my own position in the world, where, like many writers, I often feel slightly out of place. My father must have recognized this, and having received it as I did, folded into an envelope with a citation carefully written in his hand beneath it, I've come to regard it as a kind of private coat of arms, a statement of belief for those of us whose beliefs are altogether too bound up with what we work at day in, day out, to be readily compressed and spoken of in any spontaneous or casual way. It's this respect for words and what Patrick Kavanagh calls the gift of the mind that represents Ireland for me. Because Ireland for me is, like for many of us here, my father and his father. Both are better men than I will ever be, as it were. But I learned from them, if nothing else, the importance of speaking out at all times the correct words for the subject at hand, to seek the most accurate and most honourable means of expression possible at the time. I choose for the title of this lecture, Ireland as a State of Mind, while thinking of Seamus Heaney's lecture, England of the Mind, which he gave at Berkeley in 1976, and which I reread several times while writing my PhD thesis on the English poet Ted Hughes. Discussing the work of Hughes, Geoffrey Hill and Philip Larkin, Heaney describes their Englishness as deposits in the descending stories of the literary and historical past, and talks of a desire present in their language to perceive in the rituals of show Saturdays and race meetings and seaside outings, of church going and marriages at Whitsun, and in the necessities that crave expression after the ritual of church going has passed away, to perceive in these a continuity of communal ways and a confirmation of an identity which is threatened. As an Irish writer reading this, I ask myself, what of Ireland is my language signifying? What identity am I confirming? What old ways am I attempting to continue? I can think of some, but it's not done in a way that I thought or even hoped it would be. My own experiences in Loch Carrib and Loch Arrow, fishing at night with my father, rowing the boat across a still lake, has left an indelible mark on my consciousness. But the mark wasn't pure. It couldn't be. I grew up in a capital city in the late 20th century, and the media and the flow of images and sounds coming into Ireland at that time was overwhelming. Of course, we were surrounded by a rich literary tradition. As teenagers, we studied Portrait of the Artist for the Leaving Cert. As students, we waited for the last bus outside Oscar Wilde's house in Merrion Square. As lovers, we sat at Cavanagh's leafy canals and walked Joyce's dirty streets along the Liffey. And when we waited to board our first Ryanair flight out of Dublin, we queued by billboards showing the famous faces and the famous quotes of these great Irish writers. But there was another side to our experience. One of the poems that I most remember from childhood is The Lake Isle of Innisfree. We were taught it as infants in school, and I can recall reciting it in classrooms in Dublin, meaninglessly chanting my way through it, until finally reaching the conclusion, I hear it in the deep heart's core. All monosyllables, all powerful. But I didn't know then quite how powerful it was, or why. Yes, I too listened carefully to the lake water and the seawater, but I was also listening carefully to English and American pop songs. I wanted Bob Dylan, Elvis, Johnny Cash, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Sid Vicious. I don't know how many of my classmates turned out to be poets. Somewhere along the way, I did hear something in the deep heart's core, but it was, of course, in a different way to Yeats. As a result, my writing is, by necessity, impure, which is not to say corrupted, but it is hybrid, an amalgam, a memory, an experience and a sound of home mixed with something else, something foreign, something slightly at odds with normality. You could argue that this is precisely the point, that departure is vital for any artist, the need to be outside of experience in order to shape it and to not be overwhelmed by it. As an Irish woman, I'm keenly aware of independence. I'm suspicious of systems of power or being told how to behave. In addition to this, growing up in Dublin, where every street sign, every road sign, every announcement on the Dart is in two languages, English and Irish, I gained a valuable plurality of experience. I suspect that all of this has had a great impact on me in the way my mind works, especially regarding my interest in poetry and translation, and in the idea that there are many alternative ways of saying what you mean. Well, tonight I wore a hat to Glucksman House, and I lay it here on this stage area as a symbol of Ireland, my Ireland, which is to say my father and my grandfather. And I think the members of my family that I just met today for the first time will know they're known for wearing hats such as these. But really, the fact that I place it here on a stage is particularly relevant because it suggests that the true home for someone like me, like us, is in a place as open and as without identity, or perhaps with the potential for multiple identities, as a theatrical platform. It is, of course, also a place where words and the way that we choose to use them is of the utmost importance. Furthermore, the fact that I feel I can say this here in New York, as far away from Ireland as I've been to date, is proof that distance, while often painful, can also be necessary for true self-discovery and self-expression. As the Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva wrote, no one has yet understood how completely and how deeply faithless we are, which is to say, how true we are to ourselves. Thank you. Right, now the poem. This first poem is called Rape Seed, and I'm wondering whether, is it right that here you say you call it rape, that there's sort of the yellow plants that grow, I'm not sure. Anyway, Rape Seed. He thought my clothes were my skin. He thought these soft things, this lace and these buttons, were things I belonged in, but I do not belong in them. I told him, but he didn't see. Look, he went on stroking my gloves and my things, thinking, what fine skin. Oh, Mr. My. I did take thee and thou me. And after the ceremony, quiet. We drove past rapeseed. Feels of it through the window on the full, hot air. Oh, sweet, oh, stale, oh, clinging to the air. Oh shame, oh full, oh cruel. How we feared its fierceness. How we worried it would overlook us. We feared too much. thinking the world is reached only in violence. I think a lot of poets go to a lot of trouble arranging their manuscripts when they send them off to be finally put into book form, trying to decide which poem should go first and, you know, the sequence of poems and things. Of course, not everybody reads a book of poems in sequence, and I've also noticed that rarely at a poetry reading will I ever read the poems in sequence, so I don't know why I bothered, but anyway, tonight I'm going to read, the next four poems I'm going to read happen to be all in a row. We'll see how we get on. So this is the first poem in the book, and it's set at the opening of an art exhibition in a gallery. It's called Looking at Lucy's Painting of the Thames at Low Tide Without Lucy Present. Water is terribly difficult to paint. And to drink also, don't you find? It's terribly difficult to drink water. In winter, in particular. Lucy says we must drink 8 glasses a day, but the truth is, I can't abide it. Lucy's face looks terribly bruised, do you find? Especially under artificial light. Is everything all right with Lucy, do you think? She seems quite abstracted most of the time. And artists will insist on painting water, despite its obvious difficulty, and above all, its secrecy. They say the marine world is notoriously close-knit. I've tested, of course, the work. I simply can't stand the academic realism of the whole endeavour. That's not to say it isn't worth something. On the contrary. This is acting school. Tomorrow is the day of the main performance. I play, not by choice, a sprightly, foul-mouthed American. Generally, the cast is following the Strasbourg method. We never try to be jealous or stirred up for no reason at all. In today's rehearsal, we begin, as always, with articulation. Lips trill, jaw spring, palate soft, tongue pointing out from the mouth, and we are humming all the while, humming all the time, and all the time centering, rubbing the centre, and rocking and aligning, pulling the string up from the crown and not the chin, looking out with the eyes and not the chin. And before speaking, before singing, all the time increasing our capacity for breath. The director has told us that exiting well is an art. It will prove no less vital to your life as an artist, he says, than entering. While a good entrance might be slightly more central, exiting well could be a turning point in your career. And now we must practice how to drink water when there is no water. Once Aoife ceases to argue about the fact that we have nothing in our mouths, we can get on with the task of learning. Swallowing air, as the director says, might not be the same as swallowing water, but for our purposes at least, there is a sufficient amount of physical truth in what we do. I like to think that that's a total parallel of writing poems. And then continuing with the theme, this is called Water is Difficult. Oxygen and hydrogen in a liquid state, convertible by heat into steam and by cold into ice. Mr. H. Fowler, Mr. F. Fowler, you do make things sound nice. In summary, water is a liquid consisting chiefly of this. Just one of these things, so the Fowlers say, is due to appetite. But I have a thirst, I have a fear, I have a sin of. And Lucy is on her knees before you, water, admitting that she might not believe. What does it do? What does it do, she asks, except leave? Tell her, before she herself decides to go. Things break, even water. Water must break if we are to enter and live. And this one, fourth in the row. I should have mentioned that I did this PhD, you know, but as a poet, it was a ridiculous thing to think that I could do. I mean, I did manage it eventually, but it was extremely torturous. I didn't find it easy at all to write, you know, in a linear, sort of coherent way. And so everything had to be written about a million times before I got it right. So while I was doing this PhD, I, as a kind of release, I suppose, I would invent characters in my poems that rebelled against the whole thing. And so that was really quite good fun that I could do that. And this is one of these poems, and it has an epigraph which just is, "No negotiation, no negotiation before departure." And it's called "All Fool's Day, an Academic Farewell." In this paper, I will make no direct reference to the above title, or expand on the possible relevance of my argument, symbolic or otherwise, to the main topic. I will go on to plagiarise several well-known poets and writers without citing their work or acknowledging their influence on my thoughts in any way. See, for example, the epigraph to this abstract, a quote which was taken from the leader of the opposition in Cairo, 2011, yet used here out of context in an entirely inappropriate setting. Finally, I will put to myself the same questions that my examiners, so I have been warned, will put to me. Each of my answers will be indirect, unsuitable, and ultimately unclear. I shall fail, in other words, to satisfy the criteria set by the examiners and their governing board. Don't ask who's keeping house. No one's keeping house today. That was a great poem to write. I felt much better. Well, you've been a great audience, and this is the last poem I'm going to read, and it's the last poem in the book. And the title poem. And it's a love poem. This is Yarrow. In this country house, I had a dream of the city. As if the thick yarrow heads had told me. As if the chokered dove had told me. Or the yellow elder seeds had made me ask. And in the dream, I went up to the dirty bus station. And I saw the black side of the power station. And as if the brown moth tapping at the window made me say it, I said, "Do you still love me?" And when I woke and went to the window, your tender voice told me, "This is Yarrow, this is Elder, this is the collared dove." Thank you very much for listening.
I'm here at Glucksman Ireland House with Professor John Horgan, who is the Burns Library Visiting Scholar for fall semester 2014. The Burns Scholar is out of Boston College, and I'm delighted to welcome Professor Horgan to us here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. In fact, his first visit to our campus and to our home here at 1 Washington Mews. So very welcome, and thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come in and have a chat to us here today. Can I ask you a little bit about how you came to be the Burns Scholar for this semester, or your interest in coming to the United States?
I was coming to the end of my term of office as Press Ombudsman for Ireland, a new position which I've held for the last 7 years, and I felt, if you like, that there was one more kick in me before I retired, and somebody suggested this, so I drafted an application and sent it in and went through whatever processes they go through in Boston College, and eventually they said, "Look, in principle, yes, but let us decide when we'll ask you for." They asked me for this semester, and this semester or next semester would have been fine. Privately, I'm rather glad it was this semester, because the Boston winters after Christmas, I know, are fairly cold. We were here in about 27 years ago when I was a fellow at Harvard, and we remember New England winters with some trepidation.
So yes, it isn't your first dip into academia in the United States.
No, we spent a whole year in 87-88, right. And that was a fascinating experience too.
So you've written some acclaimed political biographies of people like Mary Robinson, Sean Lamass, and Noel Brown, and you've also authored a critical history of the Irish media since 1922. Can I ask you what you're up to in terms of your current research interests?
My current research interests, I've become fascinated fairly early on in media history and journalism history. One of Joe Lee's chickens, if you would like to put it like that, he supervised my PhD, but that hasn't much to do with media. I've been driven towards approaching media in a different sense from that which a lot of scholars approach it, simply as a secondary source, as a kind of resource. You use media and newspapers and stuff to fill in a few gaps. I believe that media in general are important cultural artifacts in their own right and deserve a bigger place in the cultural history spectrum than they've been given up to now. Last year I published a book called Irish Reportage with Penguin in Dublin, and that was simply about 60 or 65 extracts from Irish journalism from 1922 up to the present day, which were either extraordinarily well written pieces of reportage by journalists who could write, or also stuff by writers who could behave as journalists. A classic example is a piece by Colin Cobeen when he did his walk along the border and reported that as a reporter would have done. Emily O'Reilly writing about Gerry Adams' first election, travelling around with him in Belfast. I'm a great fan of what I call shoe leather journalism, fresh air journalism, where people, instead of sitting in front of a screen and re-engineering stuff that's coming in at them from all different sources, they wear out shoe leather, going out, seeing things that are really happening, talking to real people. And I think these first-person witnesses, even though they're limited in some respect, because journalists like American history students of Irish history don't know what happened next, they have a vividness and they can help to put things into a kind of perspective that historians sometimes lack.
How much has your background, and for those of our listeners who are not aware, you were writer and editor for the Irish Times from 1962 to 76. How much has that influenced you as a historian?
Well, it's almost the other way around, really, because I started off as a journalist, and then after a period in the Irish Times and a period in politics, I went into academia, and for a couple of years I taught how-to journalism. And it wasn't until after a couple of years that I got a bit bored by the kind of the repetitiveness of, you know, same lecture this year as last year, or not much different. And so I signed up for the PhD with Joe, and suddenly I was thrust into archives and in-depth interviews with people, and that was just a revelation to me. I just thought, if this is academic research, why did nobody tell me it was such fun?
Mm-hmm.
And it is like journalism, it is like turbocharged journalism, mm-hmm. really. And when you go into an archive and you're doing your doctorate and you realize you're being actually paid to read somebody else's letters,
mm-hmm.
you know, that has a great pizzazz to it.
So when you undertook interviews or things like that for your research,
yes.
I mean, fundamentally it was quite similar to what you did when you were wearing, quote unquote, your journalist cap, right?
It was and it wasn't. I learnt the hard way. I remember one of my first interviews was with a very elderly civil servant who was about 90 for the Damask book and for the doctorate. And I thought, well, I have good interviewing skills. I'm going to be able to get some good stuff out of him. And I came away and I looked at my notebook and I listened to my tape recorder and there wasn't anything on it. And I thought, was he avoiding me? And I realized, no, he wasn't avoiding me. But I hadn't prepped enough. I hadn't boned up on what he might have known, on what he sat through, what he experienced, so that I could ask him the kind of questions that would unlock what he wanted or perhaps didn't even know that he wanted to say. Mm-hmm. So after that, I prepped a lot better for the interviews.
Do you find that people are more willing to talk to you when you're doing historical research as opposed to coming as a journalist or vice versa? Or?
They are, yes, but partly because the conditions are clearer. You know, you have to clear it with them in advance. When you leave after an interview, I would always say to somebody, look, when I've decided what I want to use this interview, I'll run it past you to make sure I've got it correctly and so on. On the other hand, you have your problems, and you as an oral historian will know this as much as well as anybody else. The people you kind of talk to when you're doing historical research, as apart from the documentary research, there are people who were so busy doing something else that they actually don't know anything about what you want them to talk to you about. There are people who know quite a lot, but don't feel they want to tell you, or don't feel they want to tell you just yet, because there are other people alive and so on. And there are other people, and I met one or two of these, particularly in politics interviewing, who know something that's important and valuable. And they know that they are the only person left alive who knows it, and they're not going to tell you, and they're not going to tell anybody, because they know that when they die, it will die with them.
Mm-hmm.
That is the most frustrating experience you can have, and I've had a few of those too.
When you talk about what moved you as a journalist in terms of getting your hands dirty, in other words, like in the ground and out and meeting people, have there been Irish-American journalists who you've watched or read in terms of people who thought you style you liked, or is that an unfair question?
Well, it's going back a while, but people like, I had a very soft spot for Pete Hamill, whom I met when he was over in Ireland during the Troubles. If I remember it correctly, I had an amazing journey, car journey, once I was driving back down from Derry to Dublin in a small car, and Pete Hamill and Nell McCafferty were in the back seat.
Oh, wow.
And you can imagine, I wish I'd had a tape recorder just to take a note of that. But I'm a great fan of good American journalism because it's very conscientious, very serious. they don't like to give space to anonymous calumniators, you know, just to knock people down without showing their faces. And they have a great regard for facts, which mm-hmm. there's a danger in journalism generally, and I do notice it a bit in Ireland, that we have a journalism of assertion, you know, that whoever speaks the loudest or has the most colourful opinions, you know, gets the column inches. And that's an important part of journalism, but it's not the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I know it's a really big question, but in thinking about the interplay between history and journalism,
yes.
the new media, the new ways in which people find out information, it's no longer going down the street and buying the New York Times or the Irish Times or whatever.
Yes.
Could you describe the greatest advantages and
disadvantages
of those
yes.
changes?
Well, I suppose I'd start with the disadvantages, because the new media have absolutely driven a coach and four through the economic model of the old media, and that's something the old media is having to come to terms with. The advantages are probably at least as significant, but it'll take a while before the advantages and the disadvantages balance out. The advantages are that there is more access now to information, free, than there ever has been, I think, in human history, certainly in the developed world. A secondary advantage is that the new media sometimes act to keep the old media honest. You know, remember when one of the American networks published something inaccurate about George Bush's military record? It was the new media that sorted it out and got them to admit that they'd made a mistake. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the two. I tend to feel that over time, the new media will develop in much the same way as the legacy media did, that some of them will begin slowly to stand out from the crowd and will be seen to be more reliable and more trustworthy, because reliability, authenticity, verifiability, these are the USPs of the legacy media, and the legacy media should stick to them because that's what they do best, and the new media should aspire to them.
For those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Press Ombudsman, is there an equivalent here in the United States?
Not really. There was a National News Council back in the 80s, and that kind of died a horrible death because basically none of the big beasts, the Washington Post, New York Times, wanted to subject their reporting standards and ethics and so on to an organization which was composed of maybe smaller newspapers and less significant people. But on the other hand, there is another model in the States which is quite powerful and which I'm also a fan of, if you like. It's the in-house ombudsman, Margaret Sullivan in the New York Times, for example, who takes very seriously criticisms of the paper, writes about it. Her writing is not, I assume, subject to editorial control. She's allowed to say what she likes about the paper and about the people who work for it and about their job and reporting. So you can have two things. You can have an external kind of invigilator, if you like, or you can have an internal invigilator. And either of them can work depending on the culture and the circumstances.
Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this? You were Ireland's first
press ombudsman.
What was the context in which that role came about?
It developed in the way that similar institutions developed in many countries, as a defensive mechanism. Because what tended to happen, it certainly happened in Ireland back in the early 2000s, was that governments who have always been suspicious of the media and of the press, particularly because the press is unregulated in the way that radio and television are regulated, they decided, well, let's have a bit of statutory control around here in the interest of quality, in the interest of protecting people's reputations, in the interest of controlling the cowboys and so on and so forth. And the newspapers in Ireland, who, like all newspapers, are terrified by the idea of state control of what they're allowed to publish, apart from the laws of libel and contempt of court and things like that. So finally they got their act together, they pulled together, they decided to set up an organization called the Press Council and to fund it. And the Press Council hired me as the Press Ombudsman, and it's a very interesting balance of power, because the journalists and newspapers that set up the Press Council decided what their ethical standards would be, but it's up to me and the Press Council to decide whether they've broken them or not. So they don't have any input. I mean, there are some members of the newspapers on the Press Council, but they're in a minority. And even though I've been a journalist, I'm totally independent of the media. So we're, in practice and in operation, we've been totally independent both of our funders and of government. And I think that was essential to achieve any measure of public credibility for what we do.
Do you think, John, in your lifetime, it's fair to say that the readership of the Irish Times more generally has expanded in terms of its accessibility or the willingness of people? You know, it was seen in a certain way historically for the readers and people who bought it. And do you think it's widening?
But I think that's true of all newspapers.
Right.
The problem that newspapers have is how do they get people to pay for and financially support news gathering, which is one of the most expensive forms of intellectual activity you can visit.
Mm-hmm.
It is terribly expensive producing good, reliable, honest, authoritative news. So they have to crack that code sooner or later, and I have a feeling that they will.
Just one last question. You're teaching a course while you're at Boston College on the politics of constitutional change in Ireland from 1922 to 2013. How do the students at Boston College respond or engage with the topic of that? It's a big topic in Irish history.
Oh, it's a big topic. And one of the things I'm doing, actually, to make it more relevant to them, I'm looking at the Irish Constitution partly through the prism of the American Constitution, and looking at the American Constitution parties with the prism of the Irish Constitution, because there are lots of similarities between them, more than you might think, and some of the difficulties that arise are quite similar. So to that extent, there's enough common ground for them to be involved in, and I find them extremely interested and eager to learn.
So we know that Eamon de Valera had a huge hand in
terms
of that. Do you, in your reading of it and how you teach and everything, you're confident that Dev had a fairly good understanding of the American Constitution?
I think the bits and pieces of what he wrote were based on the American Constitution to some extent. Mind you, it's lasted, I wouldn't say intact, but since 1937, and that is some achievement for a constitution. But as people have become more politically aware nowadays, and the deficiencies and shortcomings of that constitution become more obvious, it's become much more politicized than it was up to about 1959 or 1960. And that's a really interesting phase that we're going through at the moment.
So you're back in Ireland from Christmas
from
time,
Christmas
and
on,
what
yes.
will you be doing in the spring?
Oh, scratch my head wondering what I'm going to do next.
But listen, thank you for coming in to chat to us today. It's wonderful to welcome you here to Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, and we hope that the rest of your time at BC is productive, and we hope we see you back here again
soon. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and Glucksman House is everything I imagined it would be.
Very good. That's nice to hear that. Thank you so much, John. We are coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, and on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Slán agus beannacht.